Hello again. This is Physics 142 lecture for October 25th, 2007. Hello from Fermilab. You see on the left-hand side a picture of the Fermilab high-rise. Fermilab stands for Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. It's the site of the highest energy particle accelerator in the world today. It will be superseded by the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in about a year, but right now this is the highest energy collider. You can see the footprint of the accelerator facilities from the air on the right hand side. At any rate, perhaps the particle accelerator detector presentation group will talk more about Fermilab among other detectors or accelerators later in the term. At any rate, let's go to slide 2. Last time I introduced the magnetic field defined with or symbolized by large case B vector. And we generalized the electrostatics force law that we had earlier into the Lorentz force law, which is shown at the top of the page in red circles. F is equal to QE plus QV cross B, where V is the velocity of the particle, B is the magnetic field, E is the electric field. We're more or less not going to use the electric field for a little while now. We're mostly going to concentrate in terms of the magnetic field. But if an electric field is present, then it does what it does to the charge, regardless of whether or not there's a magnetic field there. Note that you can do some pretty interesting things with both electric fields and magnetic fields, since if you have a charge in a bit of space and it's not moving, but you happen to have an electric field there, it will accelerate and begin to move. If there's also a magnetic field, initially the magnetic field doesn't do anything because the particle's not moving, but once the electric field gets the particle moving, then the magnetic field starts to change the direction of the particle. So you can configure electric and magnetic fields to do all sorts of interesting things to particles. Note the cross product in the second term of the Lorentz force law. This really makes life three-dimensional when you deal with magnetic fields. And most people find that when you get to magnetostatics, which is what we're studying now, life is a bit more complicated than it is in electrostatics. And that complication really arises from this cross product, which makes everything go three-dimensional. If you haven't reviewed the cross product after the last lecture, please do so. You're going to need to get very good at the cross product and develop an intuition for what it's doing in terms of directions of all sorts of quantities. If we take the second term of the Lorentz force law and basically ask what does this do to a current carrying wire, then you get the equations that I have at the bottom of the page. The force is equal to the current times L cross B, where L is basically the length of the wire that's in the magnetic field, where I turn it into a vector which has a direction, which is the direction of the current. Sometimes it's simpler to think in terms of L I cross B, which is the second equation I write down at the bottom of the page, where L is the scalar length of the wire, and you think of I as the little vector. So use whichever form fits the problem and your intuition best. Also, I put a Java applet on the class website entitled Magnetic Field, and it's certainly worth your while to look at that and play with it. So I hope you do that. That's what's taking the place of our demo for the last class. I have another one to include in this class. Let's go to page 3. I think it's instructive when we start talking about magnetism to basically look at what we have in magnetostatics and compare it to what we typically have in electrostatics. I hope you can't hear what's going on here. I'm actually sitting in my hotel room talking to myself, basically recording, feeling like an idiot. But the cleaning crew is just outside my door vacuuming, so if you hear that, sorry about that. They'll be gone in a few minutes. Hopefully you can't hear it at all. At any rate, back to slide 3. In electrostatics, if you look at the left-hand side of slide 3, recall that we had Coulomb's law, and we described the electric field at point P, where I have the pink Roman numeral 1 circled. The electric field at point P due to point charge Q is given by KQ over R squared in the R hat direction. And of course the force is Q times E. And if we looked at the charge distribution down at the bottom where I have Roman numeral field 2, Roman numeral 2 in a circle, we have some arbitrary charge distribution, and the charge distribution is defined basically in a region given by the r prime vector, and at a given point r prime you have a differential charge dq, which is equal to rho dv. One can ask, what is the charge due to the distribution at point P given by vector r? From the point dq, the relevant vector to define the electric field is the vector r minus r prime. The differential electric field is kdq over this r minus r prime vector, magnitude squared, and the direction is given in the direction along this r minus r prime vector. This you're very used to doing, I hope. This is basically what we've seen in electrostatics. In magnetostatics, rather than Coulomb's law, we have what is known as the law of Biot-Savart. So we're now on the right-hand side of slide 3. In the law of where the law of Biot-Savart is concerned, the magnetic field is caused by moving currents. So if we have a charge Q, I'm now looking where I have Roman numeral 3 circled, if we have charge Q moving with velocity V, which is a vector, and we ask what is the magnetic field at point P, which is defined to be at a point given by vector displacement vector r, the magnetic field at P due to this moving charge is equal to mu 0 over 4 pi, which is all a constant, times the magnitude of the electric charge of charge Q times the velocity of Q cross r hat over r squared. This looks very different from Coulomb's law, but it actually has many similarities. Mu 0 over 4 pi is very similar to what we've seen for electrostatics, which is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Mu 0, rather than being permittivity of free space, is called the permeability of free space, and it is a constant that's equal to 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 units of Tesla meter over amperes. Note that this magnetic field expression, Biot-Savart, is a 1 over r squared dependence, in the same way that we had a 1 over r squared dependence in electrostatics. There the similarity begins to end, and it's a bit more complicated. Note that the magnetic field at the point P up at the top right of the page is not along the velocity vector nor along r vector, but it's at right angles to the two of them. And this now, it becomes a little difficult to visualize, but basically in your mind, you need to move the origin of the r vector to the point P and the origin of the v vector to the point P and imagine doing the cross product using the right-hand rule, to determine what the direction of the magnetic field will be at point P. And then the magnitude you calculate using the expression of Bias of Art. So one of the most difficult things in magnetism is simply visualizing how things work using Bias of Art. If this makes you uncomfortable when you're first doing it, just stick with it. I think it's much harder to visualize magnetic fields initially than it is electric fields, but you do get used to it, and one of the reasons I'll give you lots of homework problems is to give you the opportunity to get used to it, and then you'll get very good at it. Now, in electrostatics, we have a static distribution of charges, point charge, net, discrete, a bunch of discrete charges, or some sort of charge distribution. In magnetostatics, the analogous thing are currents. So we have electric currents in space. They can be a smooth distribution. They could be discrete currents, like a series of wires hung through a room. Could be any of this. So we talk about current distributions when we do magnetostatics. Let's go to slide 4. Now, I think that Bias of Art in and of itself doesn't, I mean, it is hard to visualize and deal with, but I think it is a little easier to deal with Bias of Art on the differential level. So what I would like to look at now, basically, would be the magnetic field at the origin of a current loop. So I have, where I have Roman numeral 2 drawn, you can see a current loop in the YZ plane, and X would be the axis going through the center of this supposedly circular current loop. Unfortunately, I didn't actually draw this very circular, but try to imagine it's more of a circle than an egg shape. I think Bias of Art, it's very difficult to tell what's going on if you just look at something like this. So the way to do these types of problems, just like we do with charge distributions, smooth charge distributions in electrostatics, is to take a little differential piece of the current and look at what it does at point P. So if you look on the upper right of slide 4, where I have a Roman numeral 1 in pink. Imagine that we have a current, a straight line moving along, a straight current, which is the brown line, and little I represents the direction of the current. Imagine if we had a little differential length of this current-carrying wire or current. Okay, we'll call that differential length dl. That dl is at a certain position. It basically represents a differential current in space. And from the law of Bias of Art, it will create a magnetic field at point P, which is at position defined by vector r from the little differential current dl. So from Bias of Art, if we basically just write down Bias of Art, we now have a differential dB at point P due to the length dL of the current, or the bit dL of the current. And now we write the differential form of the right-hand side of Bias of Art. So we have mu 0 over 4 pi, because that's a constant that's always there. The Q times the velocity, in this case you think of it as a little current carrying wire, is going to be the current magnitude I times dl vector. Now, I is a fixed magnitude. What is differential in this problem is the length of the current that we are considering. But we have to basically hide that length in a cross product, so we create it as a vector. This is a case where you can sort of use that form IDL cross. Uh, I'm going to use the idea of, instead of thinking of the current as a vector, I'll take the length as a vector. All right. So the differential piece here is dl, which I basically make a vector and give it a direction in the direction of the current, and cross that into r hat, and you divide by r squared. This is the differential form of the Biot-Savart for that little piece dl and the magnetic field at point P. And now the game is to simply take this and integrate it over the entire current distribution. So let's look at the example where I have the Roman numeral 2. We have a current loop in the YZ plane. X is the axis that goes through the center of the current loop. And we want to know the magnetic field at point P. If we imagine that the little place where I've denoted through Roman numeral 3, I point to a little region of the current loop, which is our differential dl. Sorry to get quiet for a second, but I'm writing a little bit of this. Well, there's not really a place for me to write it, so never mind. At any rate, Roman numeral 3 points to a little segment of the current loop, which you can consider to be dl. And it also, you have the current I moving through that dl. And that little differential dl is a vector r from point P, and R is shown in the sketch, Roman numeral 2. So you now have a situation that is more or less what you see up where I have Roman numeral 1 on the upper right-hand side. You might say, well, but dl is curving here, so it's complicated. dl is a differential length, so on the along the length of the loop, it looks straight, so it's pretty, you know, it looks a lot like what we have for 1. At any rate, what we want to do is find B at the origin here, and since the differential expression for B goes as IDL cross R, we have to determine what we mean by that. And in this case, I is a constant, dl represents a length along, basically an arc length along this piece of current loop, and we have to give it a direction. So if you imagine that dl is a vector that is going in the direction of I, and you move that little vector to point P, and then you move the vector R, which goes from dl to P, and you move the vector R to the point P in your mind, and you then do the cross product of the two, you'll see that using the right-hand rule, IDL cross R is going to be in the minus x hat direction. So it's going to be to the left if you imagine the YZ plane being perpendicular to the screen. So IDL cross R becomes I times DL, basically times minus X hat. So DB becomes mu 0 over 4 pi times IDL over R squared in the minus X hat direction. DL we think of as basically arc length along this loop. And what we now want to do is integrate over the entire current distribution, because each little differential dl of the current loop will contribute to the magnetic field at point P. It may not seem obvious initially, but since the way that we've drawn figure 2 is basically invariant no matter how we go around the loop, you're going to find that every differential dl contributes the same magnetic field in the same direction at point P. So B, if we go to pink Roman numeral 4, the magnetic field B is equal to mu 0 over 4 pi, and now we integrate what we had as dB up above. The mu 0 over 4 pi pulls out. We want to integrate around the arc length because we assume dL is approximately dS. I is a constant, and in this case, the magnitude of R is a constant. So I and R pull, R squared pull out, and dS is the arc length of the circle, and we're going to integrate around the entire circle from 0 to 2 pi R. So we have mu 0 over 4 pi times I over R squared, which I'll pull out, and then the integral of dS from 0 to 2 pi R is just 2 pi R, or the circumference of the circle. And this is all in the minus x hat direction. Pulling everything together, I get a final answer that the magnetic field at the center of a current loop is mu 0 I over 2 R in the minus x hat direction. Okay, so that is how you use BOS of art. And as you can imagine, depending on the current distribution, this could be almost arbitrarily hard, in much the same way that calculating the electric field in a brute force way can sometimes be quite hard. The same is true for the law of BOS of art. It's a good idea to have a decent feel for the direction of magnetic fields around straight wires and in current loops. And in fact, there are a couple of right-hand rules that can help us. For an infinite current-carrying wire, you can use a visualization of BOS of R in order to figure out the direction of the magnetic field and all the, you know, that's true for any distribution of a current. But in the case of a current carrying wire, a very convenient right-hand rule is the following. If you grasp the wire with your hand, which I attempt to show a picture by Roman numeral 1, you grasp the wire in your hand with your thumb pointing along the direction of the current. The way that I've drawn this hand, it may not be so obvious, but the way that your hand in this picture, it's your right hand and it's curling around the wire such that the fingers are coming out at you, okay? And your palm is down, curls up underneath the wire. So that's the orientation. Your thumb points along I, make sure you're using your right hand, not your left hand. I is the direction of positive current flow. And in this case, your fingers will be curling around the wire in the direction of the magnetic field. And if you look at the symmetry of the law of BOS of art, you'll actually notice that for a infinite straight current, you're going to have the magnetic field only having a radial dependence, and it's going to basically encircle the wire in the direction given by your fingers here. So if you look at the sketch where I have Roman numeral 2 circled, we imagine the wire in the middle where the current is coming out at you. So I basically just have a black dot there. And if you use your right-hand rule now, you grasp the wire with your thumb basically coming out of the screen in front of you, your fingers, if you're using your right hand, would grasp the wire in such a way that they curl around in a counterclockwise direction. And at some distance R away from the wire, you would find the magnetic field basically circling around counterclockwise, as I show in this picture. So that's the field around a current-carrying wire. To get a feeling for how this looks, how it varies with R, how it varies with the current, and how it adds vectorially with the field from other current-carrying wires, I urge you to look at the magnetostatics Java applet link on the class website. Look at it, play with it. It's very fun. I think it's a powerful visualization tool to get some feeling for what's going on around current, around the magnetic field, around currents. Just like in electrostatics, it was good to have an intuition about the electric field around a charged particle, and in your mind you could basically take that and look at whatever distribution of discrete or even smooth charge distributions, and use your intuition of the electric field around a point charge to get a picture in your mind of what the electric field of the distribution looks like, using in your mind sort of vectorial superposition. You can do the same thing with magnetic fields, but the core piece that you often want to use is the magnetic field around a line current. So it's good to play with this visualization and get a good feeling for how the magnetic field varies due to parallel line currents. There's another right-hand rule if you look down at the bottom of page 5, where I have Roman numeral 3 outlined in pink. As you've already seen, the current loop is something you'll see a lot in magnetism. Here we have a current loop where the current is circling counterclockwise. And if you imagine grasping this current loop right where I have the current I, so, and Roman numeral 4, if you use your right-hand rule that we learned just above, if you grasp that current loop with your thumb going in the counterclockwise direction around the loop, your fingers are now circling this loop such that they come up through the inside of the loop and they curl down through the outside of the loop. And in fact, in a current loop, what you'll note is the magnetic field comes in. In this picture, the magnetic field comes toward you on the inside and goes away from you on the outside of this current loop. So there is a right-hand rule you can use which is useful. You can do what we just did using the right-hand rule at the top of page 5 to sort of determine the direction of the magnetic field inside. That certainly works. Another right-hand rule of thumb, I guess you could call it, is for current loops, is to imagine this current loop is sitting in the plane of the screen like I have it drawn, and now imagine grabbing in the plane of the current loop, grab the axis that goes through the center of the current loop, perpendicular to the plane of the current loop. So where I have the symbol for B coming out in the center of this current loop, imagine if that were actually the axis of the current loop coming out toward you, and you literally grab it with your hand, your right hand. But when you grab it with your right hand, you want to make sure you orient it such that your fingers curl around in the direction that the current is flowing around the loop. When you do that, now your thumb is going to be going in the direction of the magnetic field in the center of the loop. So if you see any current loop, if you imagine grasping the axis at the center of the current loop, and the loop doesn't need to be circularly symmetric, okay? I mean, it could be some sort of strange shape, but it needs to be in the plane. You grab that current loop, or sort of the what we would imagine as the axis at the center of the current loop, with your hand, with your fingers curling in the direction of the current flow in the loop, and your thumb, your right hand thumb, will then be pointing in the direction of the magnetic field at the center of the current loop. So it's another sort of useful version of a right hand rule to use in magnetism. This particular page is sort of difficult to do using audio only. I hope I was able to paint a decent picture of you. I don't happen to have video animations of these particular rules, but I'll check in with you next week, make sure that you're happy with that. You can also discuss it in workshop. Make sure you have these versions of the magnetostatics right-hand rules at your disposal. Know how to use them, because they are quite useful. Okay, let's go to page 6. On page 6, I'd like to carry on with our electrostatics, magnetostatics analogy. On the left-hand side, you recall that we had Gauss's law that for particular types of symmetry, Gauss's law became quite simple, and it allowed us to calculate the electric field for conditions of particular symmetry with much greater ease than doing the brute force method. You've already seen that the law of Biot-Savart is complex, and we can do calculations under certain conditions of symmetry. Analytical calculations are not so bad to do. However, it has within it the potential to be a real bear if the symmetry of the problem, if it's not that symmetric. I mean, all of a sudden, Biot-Savart can be arbitrarily difficult. So within magnetostatics, we have something known as Ampere's law, which again is a relationship that turns out to be extraordinarily useful under conditions of proper symmetry. Ampere's law says that the integral of B dotted into dl, a current, let's go back to Ampere's law. Hold on, I have a mistake in this slide I want to square away. All right. I think it's better if I change this L to a DS. All right, I have to be a little bit careful here. In Ampere's law, what happens is if you were to imagine, rather than a Gaussian surface, if you were to imagine any closed loop, I guess for simplicity, we will always be thinking of these things in a plane. Ampere's law states that along this line that represents the curve that you have in your mind, you may have a magnetic field. And you can imagine traversing this curve along it. So for simplicity, imagine have an imaginary circular loop and imagine traversing this loop in a particular direction. And we'll say that as you traverse this circular loop, going along the length of the circumference of this loop, you are basically walking along the loop in little differential DSs. So DS being the arc length along the curve, along the loop. All right, and because you have a direction in which you're moving as you go around the curve, it's a vector, okay? And B dot ds, where ds is the differential piece going along the curve, around a closed loop is going to be equal to mu zero times the enclosed current in that loop. And by enclosed current, I basically mean any current that passes through the inside of that loop. So I've tried to draw this down below. Imagine that we have a current, I, and if I were to draw a circle around this current such that this current looks like the axis of that circle, the symmetry axis of the circle, that right angles to the circle, then the circle, you could imagine, is a useful Amperian loop, we call it. That's the equivalent to the Gaussian surface. The circle's perpendicular to the wire, and the wire is on the axis of the loop. What I'm saying is that if you now do an integral of B dot ds as you integrate ds around the loop, you'll get mu zero times I. I think this is one that suffers a little bit from an audio treatment without the visuals, but I'm going to carry on and try to keep in mind how hard this is and hopefully paint the picture in your mind. So let's go to slide 7. If you look at the picture at the bottom of slide 6, what I'd like to do is to use the Amperian loop that we have drawn and actually evaluate the magnitude of the magnetic field. So Ampere's law says the integral of B dot dl is equal to mu zero times I enclosed. Now, I changed the dl a moment ago to B dot ds up where I introduced Ampere's law. And the reason I did that is because we have lots of little dls. It's very common, I believe, to maximize confusion by traditionally saying the integral of B dot dl in many instances in textbooks. And I know that that's how it pops into my mind typically, which is why I had it written that way. You have to be careful about what dls we're talking about. In the law of Biot-Savart, the dl we were talking about was sort of the differential length, a differential chunk of the current. In Ampere's law, the dl in the integral is a differential length along the Amperian loop, which you're using to evaluate the current. So if you look at the drawing at the bottom of page 6, I have two dls, and I know this can be very confusing, where I have the pink Roman numeral 1, you have a dl that represents the differential current length, and where I have the 2 in Roman numeral 2, you have a dl, which is I've written capitalized, which represents the sort of a differential piece of the arc length, so maybe more suited to call it ds. At any rate, it's very common you'll see integral of b dot dl, and so you need to keep in mind which dl is which and what it is that you're doing. I think this is one of the more confusing aspects of using Ampere's law. At any rate, remember what we're trying to do. We have the situation at the bottom of page 6 where we have a line current, and I have drawn around in the plane perpendicular to that line current an Amperian loop at some radius r. And Ampere's law tells us the integral of B dot dl, where dl is a bit of arc length, around that closed loop is equal to mu zero times I enclosed. So I'm going to recognize that I have a circle and that dl is differential arc length, and I will now B dot dl is basically B dot ds. If we use the right-hand rule to determine the direction of B around the current I, and if I integrate the arc length in the same direction around the loop, you notice a few things. One is that the magnetic field is going to circle around the loop, and that magnetic field is going to be tangential to the circular loop at all points. So B dot dl is, the B and the dl are in the same direction because I'm choosing to integrate dl in the direction of the magnetic field around the loop. So B dot dl becomes magnitude of B times the arc length ds. Because I've chosen to put my Amperian loop all at one radius, so I've made it a circle that surrounds the wire. From the symmetry of the problem, I know that the magnetic field has to have the same magnitude at that radius, no matter where I am on the circle. So that means B times dS in the integral becomes a constant B, which I can pull out of the integral, and B dot dl becomes the magnitude of B times the integral of the arc length from 0 to 2 pi r. And this is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed, but I enclosed is just the little I that is the current that I'm trying to evaluate the magnetic field for. So the integral of dS becomes 2 pi r. So if we look down near where I have the pink 1, the left-hand side of Ampere's law becomes the magnitude of B times 2 pi r, and the right-hand side becomes mu 0 times little I, and I can then solve for the magnitude of B. This particular magnetic field is very useful to know and derive at will because, in a sense, a line current, an infinite line current, is almost as useful as a point charge in electric fields in terms of intuition. So I'm not big on memorization. Obviously, you can have this formula and even the derivation of it on an index card or whatever on your sheet of formulas. In fact, I may put it on the formula sheet. I've forgotten. But I think it's sort of useful enough to be able to just derive it using Ampere's law that you should be able to do that, because you'll need to do it now and then. All right, so let's go to page 8. I just want to review a little bit where we are. In magnetism, we have the law of Biot-Savart, which I've drawn. B is equal to mu 0 over 4 pi q times V cross R over R squared. And if we have a simple charge moving, then the drawing at pink Roman numeral 1 is what you should keep in mind. And both direction and the magnitude of B are given by Biot-Savart. If you have some distribution of currents, you can think of each differential little piece of current as contributing a differential dB at some point P, and basically integrate over this distribution of currents. We talk about magnetostatics, and what we really mean by that is magnetic field formed by constant currents, in a sense. So where we have discrete charge distribution in electrostatics and magnetostatics, you basically have a discrete set of currents. Or you might have a current distribution that may vary smoothly. So what I mean by that is you could imagine having a current-carrying wire that you visualize slicing open without affecting the current, and actually having the current flow through the wire be an uneven function of R. Maybe it has radial dependence or something. So like in the middle of the wire, you have a lot of current flowing, and in the outer part of the wire, you have much less current flowing. And in that way, you can have a smooth current distribution that you have to integrate over to get a magnetic field. That could be hard. Biot-Savart can be a pain depending on what kind of distribution you're given. So we have Ampere's law on page 9, typically written as integral of B dot dl is equal to mu 0 I enclosed, where B dot dl is evaluated around a closed loop in a plane in much the same way that we do integral of E dot dA in Gauss's law, where you integrate over a closed surface. Sometimes we signify the closed loop integral by what I show at Roman numeral 1, where we put the little circle on the integral. That's basically just a way of saying closed loop. Another way sometimes it's shown where I have Roman numeral 2, you can see the integral with a little c down below. And that basically, again, is an indication that you're integrating around a closed curve. In this case, just like in Gauss's law, it is particularly useful when you are able to invent a Gaussian surface that you integrate over where E dot dA is simple and known, and the electric field is constant so that you can pull it out of the integral. In the case of Ampere's law, it could be arbitrarily difficult if you don't choose the right Amperian loop. And the right loop to choose is one where B dot dl is simple due to the symmetry of the problem, and the magnitude of B is constant along the loop. So you choose Ampere's loop, just like Gauss's law. Ampere's law is valid for any closed loop with a current passing through it or not passing through it. It's just basically a valid law, okay? Just like Gauss's law is always true. The utility of these laws comes in when you choose a Gaussian surface or an Amperian loop where the mathematics is simple. So the dot product in the case of Ampere's law is easy to evaluate, and you can pull B out of the integral because B is constant along that loop. So imagine having a current carrying wire or something like that, such as I show down at Roman numeral 3 on page 9. And perhaps I even have the current distributed as a function of R, a radial distance from the center of the wire. So I could have some I as a function of R. Just due to the symmetry of this problem, I know that the magnetic field at any distance R from the center of this wire is going to be constant, and it's going to be in a direction that is given by our right-hand rule, where we grasp the wire and our fingers curl around the wire. We can evaluate the direction of B, and we know that it is constant in terms of magnitude at that distance R, which means the symmetry of the problem dictates a useful Amperian loop to be an encircling, a ring, a circle around the wire, where the plane that contains the ring is at right angles to the wire. So the obvious Amperian loop to choose is the one that I have drawn near figure 3. And when you choose that Amperian loop, B dot dl, where dl is a little differential vector along the loop, tangential, B is always going to be along the tangent line to the loop due to the symmetry of the problem. So B dot dl becomes simple, and the fact is that B is the same magnitude at a fixed radius, so you can always pull B out of the integral. So in this particular case, the left-hand side is going to be easy to evaluate. And all you have to do is to evaluate how much current you have that actually passes through that particular loop. So this is the idea of Ampere's law. Let's go to slide 10. We've talked a lot about line currents, the magnetic field of a current loop we've talked a little bit about too, and if you recall, we determined a couple of different ways to evaluate the direction of the magnetic field in the middle of a current loop. If you think about the Biot-Savart and you apply it to positions in the plane of a current loop, like I have drawn at Roman numeral 1, pink, you can determine that the magnetic field is coming out at you inside the loop and going away from you outside the loop. So I have the magnetic field coming out at you at point P, the orange P, the pink P. So I'm referring to the little sketch where I have Roman numeral 1 in pink. The orange P, the magnetic field, is coming out at you. The pink P, the magnetic field, is actually going is going into the screen. Okay, if you look where I have Roman numeral 2, you're now looking in the plane of the current loop, and I have cut the current loop along one of its diameters, and what you have is the current going into the page where I have Roman numeral 3 and coming out of the page where I have Roman numeral 4. I'm sorry, I said that the wrong way. You have the current going into the page where I have Roman numeral 4 and coming out of the page at Roman numeral 3. And if you think about what Bia Savar is telling you, if you were to imagine these as individual lines of current, you would evaluate the magnetic field to look something like those circulating brown lines that I have around the two wires in the sketch at Roman numeral 2. This is basically the form of the magnetic field around the current loop. You have the current sort of zooming through the inside, circling around and coming back. So the magnetic field lines actually do not start and stop on any points. They are continuous sort of circles. So we call this a magnetic dipole field. Note that this is not a monopole. In electrostatics, the simplest case we have for electric fields is you have single point charges which act as the origin or the end of electric field lines. They're sort of like drains in a sink, if you will, for magnetic field lines or faucets. And you do not have that in magnetism. And you might ask why we do not have sources of magnetic field lines. If we had them, we would actually call them magnetic monopoles. And when we get to Maxwell's equations, you'll see that, in fact, the lack of a magnetic monopole blows the symmetry of Maxwell's equations. And in fact, I'm unaware of a fundamental reason why we don't have magnetic monopoles in nature, at least that we've been able to observe. And a lot of very good and serious scientists have spent careers looking for magnetic monopoles in nature. We have yet to find one. We don't really know why, but just something to keep in mind. At any rate, for this course, the simplest form of a magnetic field that we'll deal with is the magnetic dipole field. You can sort of think of this as the closest configuration, the simplest field configuration for magnetic field, so it's sort of like a point charge in electrostatics. Let's go to slide 11. I'd like to look at the magnetic field of an infinite solenoid, where a solenoid is basically like a slinky, if you want to think of it that way. It's drawn where I have pink Roman numeral 1. I've tried to draw a wire that's coiled up along a particular axis. And it's infinite in extent to the left and to the right, and we'll say that we have n loops per unit length. So if I now slice the slinky in two and we look at it along the slice, so we get the sketch of Roman numeral 2. So basically I take what we have at Roman numeral 1 and I slice it in the plane of the paper or of the screen, and you're looking at the slice piece in the screen at Roman numeral 2. Then what you have are all of the wires on the top part. The current is coming out at you, and on the lower part, the current is going in. So each current loop basically loops in and out of the screen in front of you. And if you take each individual loop and you grasp it, so for example, at the top, if you imagine that each black dot is just a wire coming out at you, and you were to grasp that wire with your thumb going in the direction of the current flow out at you, your fingers would circle the wire in the directions where I have the little pink circles. So your fingers will circle each of the wires counterclockwise, which means each individual wire will have a magnetic field that looks something like that. But you'll note, if you look down at Roman numeral 3, in the region where I have the brown square, the magnetic field circulating for adjacent wires goes in opposite directions if you look between the wires. And from the symmetry of the problem, the pieces that go up and down are going to cancel each other out, which means in the end, if you go back to Roman numeral 2, the only pieces that add together are the pieces that I show with the orange B vectors. On the outside of the solenoid, the magnetic field is going to the left, and on the inside, it's going to the right. If we look down at the lower part of the solenoid, the argument is the same, except now, on the inside of the solenoid, the magnetic field is going to the right, and on the outside, the magnetic field is going to the left. If we now add vectorially the magnetic fields from the top piece and the magnetic fields from the bottom piece together in much the same way that we added electric fields for two parallel plates together, you'll find that the magnetic field at the top cancels out, you'll find that the magnetic field outside the solenoid is all canceled out, and the magnetic field inside the solenoid is strengthened. So, in the end, for a solenoid, you have B is equal to zero on the outside, and you have a magnetic field inside, and we'll have to evaluate what the strength of that magnetic field happens to be. If you found this confusing, it might help if you imagine the drawing, too, is not a cut solenoid, but imagine it's just two sets of infinite straight wires, a plane of them basically coming out at you on the top and going into the screen on the bottom. And then, just like we did with the two planes of charge, what you want to do is to look at the magnetic field formed due to the top set of wires coming out at you and that due to the set of bottom wires beneath and vectorially superimpose them. And what you would find is that the magnetic field moving to the left beneath the wires on top, which are coming out at you, will cancel with the magnetic field going to... I said that wrong. I'm sorry. You would look at the magnetic field at the bottom of the wires that are coming out at you, which are on the top of drawing number 2, and that magnetic field is going to the right. That cancels with the magnetic field that is going to the left, which is beneath the wires which are going into the board at the bottom of the drawing of figure 2. I have a feeling that probably wasn't really clear. It would be much easier to be able to point at this and show you. But basically the message is, if you look at the contributions of the magnetic field due to the wires at the top and the wires at the bottom, they will cancel each other out outside the region enclosed by the two sets of wires, but will add together inside the region enclosed by the two sets of wires. So if we then reimpose the circular symmetry, what we find is outside the solenoid we have a magnetic field of zero, and inside we have a non-zero magnetic field. If you hold on, I have to fix it something. Okay, so if you look at slide 11, and you look where I have Roman numeral 4 circled on the lower right-hand side, what I'd like to do is to try to evaluate the magnetic field from the wires at the top of the solenoid. So these are wires that are coming out at you, current-carrying wires,
and each of them has a current I coming out at you. And I'm going to make an Empyrean loop, which looks like the blue loop where I have the pink circled four. So it's now a square, but it's still a closed loop. And on the outside of the solenoid, the magnetic field is zero by the symmetry arguments we used a moment ago. So B dot dl along that piece of the loop will be zero, will not contribute. If we look at the pieces to the left and right of this Empyrean loop, then you find that B dot dl again is going to be zero. Why? Because dl along the left-hand part of the loop is going up or down, depending on which direction you're circling around the loop. And let's assume that we're going to circle counterclockwise around the loop. So if we're on the left-hand side of the square of the squared loop, where we have the pink figure 4, pink Roman numeral 4 in a circle, the top is 0 because B is equal to 0, so B dot dl is 0. The left-hand side is 0 because although B is not 0, at least on the inside of the solenoid, B is going to be at right angles to dl as you integrate down that piece of the loop. So the left-hand side will not contribute to B dot dl. The same is true for the right-hand side. B is non-zero inside the solenoid, but B dot dl will be zero because dl is going to be perpendicular to B at that point. The only piece of this Empyrean loop which will contribute to the magnetic field, it will contribute to the Empyrean integral, is going to be the bottom piece of this little square Empyrean loop. And in the bottom piece, by the symmetry of the problem, we know that B will be along the loop. And we're circulating counterclockwise, so B dot dl is going to be the magnitude of B times the length L of the side of the loop. And all I know is that I could imagine that the magnitude of B is potentially a function of where I am inside the loop. That is, it could be a function of the radius of the radial position within the loop. I don't have a reason at this point to think that it might not be. But what I have just evaluated then, if you go on the left-hand part of the slide about halfway down, I have Ampere's Ampere's law, the integral b dot dl is mu 0 I enclosed. We have just determined that the integral of b dot dl, as I go around the Empyrean loop I've chosen by pink 4, is just the magnitude of b times l, which is the length of whatever I've chosen for this Empyrean loop. That's going to be mu 0 times I enclosed. Well, you note that the number of currents that are enclosed within this loop basically is going to be the number of loops per unit length times L, which is the length of the solenoid I have enclosed in the loop. So if I have a current little I going through each loop of the solenoid, the enclosed current is going to be I times N times big L. So Ampere's law becomes magnitude of B times big L is equal to mu 0 I n times big L. The L's cancel, and B is just equal to mu 0 times I times n. And now you get the picture number 5. The field of an infinite solenoid is actually uniform and has a strength, mu 0 I times n. So it depends on the number of turns per unit length in the solenoid and the magnitude of the current you have in the solenoid, but it is uniform within the solenoid and outside it's zero. So we have created a situation which is very similar to that we had for the parallel plate capacitors in the sense that we have a confined uniform magnetic field. So this really plays a role that's quite similar to the parallel plate capacitor that we had in electrostatics. We could also look at the magnetic field due to an infinite current sheet, and hold on a second, because I need to decide whether I want to stop here or do more with Ampere's law. I think maybe I better stop here. I know that I cover things fairly fast. I was sort of hoping to get to the end of Ampere's law for this class, but I think we have enough complication involved, and I need to double check with you when I can see your faces how closely you're getting this. So it'd probably be a good idea next Tuesday when we start class for me to do a fairly good Amperian law example or two and make sure that we're all on the same page with that. So I will stop here at the end of page 11, and I hope you all have a good weekend. Again, feel free to email me with any questions. Admittedly, we're at a point in this course where visualization is pretty important, so it could be difficult for me to answer some of the emails. If you pick the right question, but I'll do my best. And anything that can wait till Tuesday, good enough, and I'll answer them then. So have a wonderful weekend.